You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. If you're devoutly religious or superstitious, keep in mind that today's program may delve into areas that could be triggering. My guest is Nick Medina. He's the author of Indian Burial Ground and Sisters of the Lost Nation. His latest novel is The Whistler, a graphic horror novel that covers a wide range of real-life issues and spiritual and religious beliefs. Welcome to The Jefferson Exchange, Nick.
Thank you so much, Mike.
So your latest novel deals with the spiritual world, indigenous folklore, superstitions, and a wide variety of life issues we deal with in the physical realm. But before we get into the storyline of your latest book, The Whistler, let's start with you. When someone asks, who is Nick Medina? How do you respond?
I would say I'm a person who absolutely loves stories. My entire life, I've loved stories. And since I was a small kid, I knew that I wanted to be a writer. I didn't know exactly what that would lead to. I didn't know what type of writing, but stories have always been a very strong part of my life and part of my culture. And so I wanted to represent those in my work. And I think of myself as someone who is trying to keep parts of the past alive. And that's what a lot of my writing does for Native and Indigenous communities.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Chicago, actually.
You didn't grow up on a reservation?
I did not. My grandmother was actually, I should say my paternal grandmother, was born on a reservation in Louisiana. And she grew up there and ultimately moved to Chicago with my grandfather because he was in the Navy and they met in the Texas area. So that's how my family ended up in the Midwest.
Are you an enrolled member of any tribe?
Yes, I am. I'm a member of the Tunica Biloxi tribe of Louisiana, which is the tribe I referenced a moment ago. That's where my grandmother comes from.
And how far back does your family go on that tribe?
You know, I haven't traced it. I know, her mother and her grandmother were parts of the or members of the tribe as well. The tribal history is a little hard to track because the Tunica Biloxi tribe is actually it's a union of various small tribes from that area, small tribes that were nearly wiped out, and they didn't ultimately get federal recognition until the early 1980s.
So what inspired you to write?
You know, that's just something that has always been in me since I was able to form a sentence and write a sentence. When I first learned how to write, I just always did it. And it's something that I haven't been able to kind of walk away from. There was a long time when I was pursuing publishing and trying to get people to notice my work. And, you know, I was getting a lot of rejections at that time. And I would sometimes think to myself, maybe I should try something else. And I would try to walk away, but it would only last for maybe a week or two. There's just something in me that says you have to do this. It's the way I deal with my feelings. It's the way I process things. It's just a part of me.
Well, you published multiple books now. When did you first publish and what was the book about?
My first book was published in 2023. It's called Sisters of the Lost Nation. And it revolves around the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous and Native women and girls, which has been going on for a very long time in this country and in Canada. And the story is about two sisters, one of which goes missing, and the other one who will stop at nothing to try to find what happened to her sister, where she is. And I also incorporate elements of Native folklore, because I find that when you couple these social issues, these real life issues, with traditional storytelling, they seem to not only enhance each other, but they also intensify each other. You know, the real life horrors make the traditional stories that much more frightful, but those Native stories also make the real life issues that we're dealing with even more intense. And so by pairing them together, I think they play really well, and they just really work to shine a light on these issues.
Well, you tell these stories about the real and imagined worlds of Native Americans. Both can be pretty grim.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, especially with this epidemic of missing and murdered women and girls. And like I said, it's something that affects, you know, not just one tribe. It affects tribes across Indian country, even in your area. I was doing some reading about it, and I found out that the state Representative Sanchez had proposed a bill in 2019, first of its kind bill, that would declare missing Native American women as a statewide emergency and which would launch an investigation into the crisis. And they wanted to produce a report to analyze the cause of the problem and to present recommendations for dealing with that problem. But despite that bill, unfortunately, not much improvement has been made in that area. You know, some of the leaders, including the governor, has said that maybe that's because of COVID at the time and things just kind of got lost. But there are 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon, you know, one of their biggest complaints is that their voices aren't heard. They say that they weren't even involved with, you know, giving their feedback, giving their or voicing their concerns when it came to this bill. So, yeah, this is something that affects many people. Unfortunately, thousands of families are missing their daughters, mothers. And of course, when a family member is missing, it's all the rest of the family can think about, because until they find them, it's very hard to function.
Well, to your point, a national report revealed that for Indigenous females between the ages of 1 and 45, homicide is one of the top 10 causes of death, and more than 4 in 5 Native Americans report experiencing violence in their lifetimes, and more than 30% reported violence in the prior year, according to a 2022 study by the National Institute of Justice. So it was interesting to note that Oregon unanimously passed in 2020 this law that required this report to come out by the Oregon State Police. But that's somewhat of a rarity, as you pointed out.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is one of those issues that seems to get kind of swept under the rug. It doesn't get as much attention as other issues in this country. And so that's what I'm trying to do with my work, is trying to not only give readers a good scare and a good, you know, kind of thrilling story. I always incorporate elements of mystery and suspense, but I also try to incorporate these issues so that people become more aware of them. And that's one of the things I hear a lot from readers. They tell me that they're now aware of things that they had never been aware of before. And so in that way, I hope I'm doing a little bit of good.
My guest is Nick Medina, author of The Whistler. Well, Nick, here in Oregon, there have been a number of books written about the beliefs of various tribes. The World of the Kalapuya is a book published by a trio of authors from Oregon State University that paints a picture of the spiritual beliefs of the Kalapuya and other tribes of the Grand Ronde community. Many of these stories have been written about spiritual beliefs of a wide variety of tribes in Oregon, including the Rogue River Tribe, the Umpqua Tribe, Chinook and Tillamook. But these stories have a common thread of spirits in the natural world that are all around us, like in your story. Tell us about The Whistler.
Yeah, The Whistler is a story about a young man named Henry who takes things a little too far in his pursuit to become an internet famous ghost hunter. And he ends up suffering a terrible injury as a result and becomes paralyzed from the chest down, which leaves him haunted by his history of questionable behavior and perhaps even haunted by something even more sinister than that.
Well, where does the story take place?
The story takes place on a fictional Native American reservation in Louisiana. I do draw a lot of inspiration from my family's experiences and my own experiences visiting the reservation in Louisiana, where my grandmother grew up. But I decided to use a fictional reservation just so that I would have a little bit more freedom when crafting my stories, since my first three books all do take place on this reservation. Each book kind of builds off of the other. It's not necessarily a series. Each book has its own set of main characters, but I always like to focus on at least one central mystery while also addressing some unanswered questions that I had left hanging in the previous book. So The Whistler follows up on my book that came out last year, which was Indian Burial Ground.
Well, Native reservation lands seem foreign and mysterious to most Americans. The personalities of the characters in your book, though, seem familiar, like they could be part of my own family and friends.
It's nice to hear you say that, because that's part of my goal. One thing that a lot of Natives report is that they often feel as though they are not included in, you know, modern times. A lot of people think of Native Americans as something from the past, something ancient, something that only existed hundreds of years ago. But Natives really are like anybody else. We're modern people with modern problems. And, you know, we have the same issues that perhaps you and your family have. So yes, we are very much, I should say, I hope my characters are very relatable and very much like the people reading the books.
Well, you do capture the reader's attention right away. Can you read a short excerpt from your book on page 19?
Absolutely. So I'll read, this is the first page from chapter one. His eyes snap open, and all he knows is fear. Whether Henry's distress manifested before he woke in response to a nightmare, he can't remember, or if it only flooded his body the instant his eyelids opened isn't clear, nor does it matter. What's important is how he'll escape, if he ever can. His jaw flexes in a scream that would bring Pawpaw Mac and Mama Tilly running from their room at the end of the hall, wants to tear out, but doesn't. He can barely breathe deep enough to keep suffocation at bay. Somehow, since going to bed, the blanket has moved up around his neck, like a snake, constricting tighter by the second. He tries to move his arms, but they're buried beneath the blanket, 1,000 pounds heavier than when he went to bed. Even if he could move them, they'd do little good because his legs aren't moving either. And without them, he's stuck, as if the mattress were made of quicksand, the sheet one large piece of flypaper. The figure at the foot of Henry's bed, however, moves with ease.
You know, there's a lot of folks who have nightmares about being paralyzed and something being in the room. You're tapping into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually something I've experienced on several occasions myself where, I wake up and my body is completely immovable, but I'll see something or I'll just be aware that something is in the room with me. And it is a terrifying experience. So I wanted to bring a little bit of that into this book, but also kind of leave it open-ended because who knows what really is haunting Henry at this point in the story.
Well, you introduce us to a superstition that seems to be widespread among indigenous peoples about whistling at night.
Yes. There's a superstition that you should never, ever whistle at night for fear of what it might attract. And I should say that it's not just a superstition found among native cultures. It's actually one that's found worldwide, which I think is really interesting because the superstition in all of these different cultures, whether it be in China, Korea, Japan, parts of Europe, the superstition is basically exactly the same. There's no real saying where it started, where it originated. I've done research to try to find a solid answer, and I haven't been able to find one. The only big difference among these beliefs is what might be attracted to you if you do whistle at night. So for a lot of native cultures, they believe that something like a skinwalker, which can change shapes and perhaps even eat you, might attach itself to you if you whistle at night. Other native cultures believe in these small figures, sometimes call them stick Indians, but they're often described as Sasquatch-like creatures or forest-dwelling dwarves, and they think that they might attack you as well. So it's a pretty fascinating superstition. Basically, it stands as a warning, which is what a lot of folklore is, a warning about the dangers of night. And so they say if you whistle at night, you never know what might be out there, what might be attracted to you as a result. So it's better if you proceed with caution.
Does it matter where you are?
No, I haven't found anything about location playing a role. It's like I said, it's basically that warning that if you disrupt the peace of night, something bad could happen to you. And again, it's this warning that you never know what's out there at night. You never know what the dangers are. So it's better to proceed with caution.
Does it matter if it's a happy tune?
Nope. The whistle basically is a disturbance of the peace. It's thought of as a kind of this beacon that beckons either these spirits. It could be different entities. It could be different creatures. It could be the wandering dead. Doesn't matter if it's a happy tune. Doesn't matter what kind of whistle it is. You're still disturbing the peace of night.
So as the understanding, my understanding about this is that there are spirits all around us. And at night, if you whistle, you could inadvertently conjure up a spirit that attaches itself to you. Is that?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah. If you whistle at night, you can attract some sort of malevolent spirit, entity. Like I said, the different cultures could be a witch, some other supernatural creature, the wandering dead. But yeah, they can attach themselves to you. And then, of course, you'd suffer some sort of negative consequence as a result.
Okay, so if that happens, how do you know and how do you remedy it?
Great question. And that's actually one that I wasn't able to find an answer to. That's why I was able to kind of take things in my own direction with the whistler. How do you get rid of something that's attached itself to you? That's something that Henry has to figure out for himself within the book. Unfortunately, I don't know how you deal with it in real life. But really, I think it comes down to this being a superstition. We know you're probably not going to experience something like that. But again, it's just that warning. It's that aspect that scares you into acting in a specific way. So, you know, as long as you avoid it, you'll be fine.
Okay, on that note, we're going to take a short break. I'll be right back with my guest, Nick Medina, author of The Whistler. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange on JPR. Welcome back to The Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Nick Medina, author of The Whistler. Before the break, Nick treated us to an excerpt from his new novel, and we talked a little bit about whistling at night and what it could possibly mean. Nick, there's a tendency in our society to brush aside beliefs in spirits as superstitious, particularly those beliefs that are associated with indigenous tribes. But the irony here is that all around our nation and our world are Christians who firmly believe in the spiritual realm. Listen to this, quote, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places," end quote. Nick, that's an excerpt from chapter 6 of Ephesians in the New King James Version of the Christian Bible. So right here, all around me, are Christians who actually believe in the spiritual realm. And your story speaks to these spirits in the dark, wickedness in both the spirit world and inside of us, which manifests in our real world actions.
Absolutely. I think that's one thing that many cultures have in common. We have certain beliefs in something beyond us, whether it be a spirit, God, something like that. You know, we carry these beliefs and they impact how we behave, they impact how we react and relate to each other, and they dictate for a lot of us how we live our lives. And so these native stories, these traditional tales full of these intriguing characters, characters that sometimes are pretty brutal, which I've written about in my previous two books. You know, native mythology does have a lot of characters that engage in mutilation, cannibalism. But again, it all serves as some sort of warning. It's a way to remind us not to do certain things, or on the flip side, to engage in certain things which will protect us. We have these beliefs, we carry them with us. Yeah, we find them in all kinds of cultures.
Well, we're in the month of October, and lots of spooky stories, haunted houses. We have the celebration of trick-or-treating. There seems to be some sort of mockery of death and the afterlife. Why do we do this? Is this something that is done in the indigenous world?
Not to my knowledge. I haven't come across that personally, so I can't say for sure. But I think, you know, maybe we do this because it's a way to combat our fears, maybe take a little bit of control. You know, death is something, obviously, that's coming for us all. So when we dress up and we engage in behaviors that might be seen as mockery, as you said, maybe that's just a way that we kind of deal with it. Maybe it's a way we deal with our fears. Maybe it's a way we deal with the unknown, since, you know, we have so many questions that we just can't answer. You know, we might have beliefs, we might have faith about what's to come after this life, but we can't really know for sure.
You also wrote The Indian Burial Ground. What's that about?
Our Indian Burial Ground largely revolves around issues of addiction and suicide. And it's a story about a young woman whose boyfriend ends up dead, and we don't know why he's dead. There are theories that it might be suicide, theories that it might have been an accident. And so this character, she has to kind of come to grips with what happened and find some sort of peace. But it's also largely about trauma, especially intergenerational trauma. And as the name kind of suggests, it's about the things that we bury within ourselves. Because in essence, we are all a burial ground. We carry our past inside of us. We carry our traumas inside of us. And oftentimes, if we don't deal with those traumas, they come back to haunt us. And they might come back far uglier than when we first tried to shove them away in the first place. So the burial ground, in a sense, you know, there's a lot of history to the term Indian burial ground. And I don't know if you want me to get too much into that, but basically using that title and telling the story that I told about trauma and dealing with things from the past coming back to life. It was kind of my way of finding methods to cope with the things that cause us great unease in our lives.
Well, it reminds me of something I say quite often. The past, P-A-S-T, is not past, but it's past, P-A-S-S-E-D, down to each generation. And sometimes yes. our past can be passed down and continue to haunt us.
Yeah, and I love that saying. I haven't heard that before. But yeah, absolutely, you're spot on with that. You know, the things that we grow up with, those things can stick with us forever. And a lot of times, you know, especially as children, we don't know how to deal with those things. And unfortunately, sometimes there aren't elders who know how to deal with them either, because they weren't taught either. So it becomes a cycle where these traumas keep getting passed down, and they ultimately continue to have devastating effects on families and, of course, the individual who is carrying them.
My guest is Nick Medina, author of the graphic horror novel, The Whistler. Nick, you deal with a lot of serious issues, but you infuse humor into your stories as well, like in The Whistler. Tell me about that.
I get asked about humor and comedy quite a bit. And for me, it's not something that I approach very consciously. I never think of myself as a very humorous person. So I'm always surprised when people say that they find humor in my writing, because it's never really intentional. If it comes out that way, that's great. And I think a lot of people do appreciate humor within horror, because it gives you a little bit of a kind of a moment to take a breath and to maybe collect yourself. And it obviously is in contrast to the more intense scenes within the story. But yeah, I really don't plot out humor that much. I just let it happen if it happens, and I just hope it doesn't fall flat.
Well, one of the things, I'll tell you, in reading your book, I was surprised that it made me chuckle in various scenes that you wouldn't think you were going to chuckle, but...
Nice to hear.
So it works. Your main character ends up in a wheelchair, and you write about what that feels like, living life trapped inside a body with limited functionality. How do you know how that feels?
Well, personally, I don't know. And I don't think anyone who hasn't actually lived through some sort of injury or life-changing event can ever truly know what that's like. But I was able to turn to some really generous people and really giving people. First and foremost, I want to mention a young man named Peter. Peter has been in a wheelchair for almost 15 years now. And Peter got hurt when he was going on a road trip with his friends in college. He was 20 years old, and he was driving at the time. And unfortunately, Peter fell asleep at the wheel, and the SUV that he was driving rolled over and ended up crushing the back of his neck. And so Peter now lives with quadriplegia. And Peter allowed me to ask him any question I had. He didn't hold back with any of his responses, no matter how personal my questions might have gotten. Because my goal for this book was to try to depict a character as authentically as possible. And I wouldn't have attempted this book if I didn't have help from people who have lived through it. But Peter told me all about his injury, what it's like to try to come to grips with it. You know, there's a great deal of loss and grief. And it's, for me, I found it terrifying to think that at that age, when you're in college and you're making a plan for your life and you're ready to go out there and, you know, kind of grab the bull by the horns, and then suddenly you have to come up with a completely different plan for your life. And the things that you had hoped for and the things that you'd been working toward suddenly don't really matter anymore. And, you know, it was something that I found very tough to just even hear about. So I was very lucky to be able to talk to Peter. Peter also invited me to attend the Abilities Expo, which travels around the country. And I went with him when it was in Chicago last summer. And I was able to see a lot of the new technology that's being developed and the new tools that are being created to help people living with paralysis. And there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people there. It was a huge event. And it was kind of tough to see so many people living with challenges that they, of course, would not have chosen to live with. But it was also very eye-opening and inspiring to see how they continue to push forward and try to find new ways to do things that people told them they might not ever be able to do again. And, you know, one of the things I hope that this book will do is maybe, you know, make people living with disabilities more visible, or at least make them easier to understand. Because I think a lot of times people, when they see someone in a wheelchair, they kind of get scared and they don't want to interact as much. And so, you know, people who do live with disabilities often report that they feel ignored or undervalued or devalued. And, you know, they have to try to find their way in a world that wasn't necessarily built or designed with them in mind. So I'm hoping that, again, my writing might do a little bit of good and point out that we're all people. We all need help sometimes. You know, we're all just kind of trying to do our best to make it through this life.
Well, through your main character, you deal with the importance of family and friendship.
Yeah. Henry has a very strong support system. He has his grandparents, Tilly and Mac. He has his girlfriend, Jade. And he has his best friend, who's called Toad in the book. And they are people who are there for him no matter what, no matter what he's going through. Because, you know, dealing with an injury such as his and the changes that have befallen him, he's not in a great headspace. He's often very negative, very down, but they don't give up on him, especially his girlfriend, Jade. You know, she's kind of there to, you know, she doesn't accept any of his complaining, really. When he says he can't do something, she'll counter that. And you know, she kind of keeps him going, keeps him grounded in different ways. And, you know, again, that's something that I found in my research talking to Peter. That's something that, of course, is very important, to have people there who aren't going to give up on you and who aren't going to let you give up on yourself.
Well, Henry, because of his headspace, because of the challenges he's dealing with, has a lot of negativity around him and attracts a lot of negativity in the spirit world that actually impacts the others around him.
Yeah, there's various things that Henry does both before and after his injury that, and I'm trying not to give too much away, but there are things that he does before and after his injury that do lead to some pretty haunting moments in the book. And the question is, what really is haunting?
And through Henry, we learn the value of truth as a force to combat evil.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's an idea that it's been presented in other forms, other formats. But yeah, for Henry, discovering that being honest, not only with himself, but with the people who love him and support him, is ultimately the best way to keep evil at bay.
Well, aside from a haunting fear of the dark, what do you want readers to take away from The Whistler?
Well, of course, I want them to have a good time. I hope they get a good thrill out of it. But ultimately, like I was saying before, I hope that it does shine some light on various issues. I do want to touch on the issue of healthcare when it comes to Native Americans and Indigenous populations, because healthcare for many Natives is subpar, even though the U.S. government, via treaties that they made with tribal nations, is supposed to provide healthcare to Native populations. The healthcare that's provided is very underfunded, and unfortunately, Natives suffer higher rates of curable and preventable illnesses. Things like diabetes, heart disease, even acne tends to be worse among Native communities. And of course, mental health issues are a big problem as well. So, you know, I want people to be more aware of that. And also, as I was saying, when it comes to people living with disabilities, I hope this might do a little bit of good for them as well.
Well, your book is a great story, and it has many haunting scenes. It sits comfortably at the intersection of superstition and spiritual beliefs and leaves the reader still wondering at the end. Thank you for writing it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for reading it. I appreciate it.
My guest was Nick Medina, author of The Whistler. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.